Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. On today's show, we'll be talking about helping children cope with trauma. Our guest will be Sue Badeau. I think you're really going to enjoy this show. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
What we've learned from the research and experience is that, in fact, often the things we call neglect can have a more profound or complex traumatic impact on the child even than sometimes abuse can. Clearly, both are bad. We don't want either for a child, but people often think it's the abuse that's the worst thing, and we need to learn that no, neglect is at least just as bad and often worse in terms of the impact it has on the developing child.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. We are a weekly radio show, and we use the podcast model. That way you can listen whenever and wherever you want. With this 2015 has been called the year of the podcast, and indeed it has been. The growth has been exponential. With everybody walking around with a phone in their hand, you can listen to podcasts and choose exactly what you want to hear. And with smart cars coming, and most of the cars coming out now are smart cars, it will change even more. And we are glad that you have chosen to listen to us. It makes a difference. You can subscribe to the podcast to get notice of each new episode on whatever device it is you are listening to it. Just type in whatever the app you're using. If you're on an iPhone, you're using probably the iPhone podcast app, but there are many other apps. Whatever it is you're using, just type in the words Creating a Family and hit subscribe. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. All right, the last couple of weeks, my friends, you have been hearing me harp on the fact that the Ferring Heart to Heart video contest is coming to an end, and you need to get your videos submitted. You have, at this point, what's today, the 26th? You have exactly 5 more days. The deadline is August 31st. They're asking for families who have been successful at getting pregnant using one of the fertility drugs to give hope to those who have not yet faced success. The grand prize winner is a $10,000 education fund, and then there are going to be 4 runners-up, and each of the runners-up will get a $4,000 education fund. There is still time, but not much. So you need to get out your video cameras and start talking. To get more information, you can go to their website, hearttoheartcontest.com. And someone asked, that is spelled out the word T-O, not the number. So hearttoheartcontest.com. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited adoption agency, placing waiting kids from around the world, offering home study and post-adoption services to residents of North Carolina and New York. They place kids from Armenia, Bulgaria, Georgia, Ghana, Guyana, Morocco, Pakistan, Serbia, Ukraine, and they also do kinship adoptions. We have Vista Del Mar. They are a licensed, accredited, nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years of experience helping to create families. They have 3 adoption programs, private infant, international, and adoption through foster care. And we also have Children's Connection. They are an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas, providing domestic infant adoption, embryo donation adoption, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the United States. These are a few of the gold sponsors, but we also have other great sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an adoption service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, just a lot of factors that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today, we're going to be talking about helping children cope with trauma. Our guest is Sue Badeau. She is a nationally known speaker, writer, and consultant. She and her husband, Hector, are lifetime parents of 22 children, 20 of which were adopted. They have also been foster parents to more than 50 children. They are the authors of the book, Are We There Yet? The Ultimate Road Trip Adopting and Raising 22 Kids. Sue has worked in the field of child welfare for over 30 years and has developed curriculum and training for adoption social workers, judges, attorneys, and parents. Welcome, Sue Badeau, to Creating a Family.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here with you today.
Well, you know, I think it would help if people were grounded to know a little more about your story. And for those people who are listening right now, there was a wonderful article in the New Yorker magazine that came out earlier this month, which is came out August 3rd, 2015. You can also, if you're listening to it right now, we will be summarizing the article and putting a link to it in our Adoption in the News page. But if you could get more information, you can also, of course, read their book. So tell us a bit about your story. In the intro, I mentioned that you have 22 kids. That alone is enough to make us open our eyes. How did you end up with 22 kiddos?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny how it started because my husband and I are high school sweethearts, and we recently celebrated our 36th wedding anniversary. But during high school, while we were still dating, we talked about the idea that we wanted to work with children in our future careers, but also to have a family, and that we wanted our family to include children who might not otherwise have a home. So this was something, a seed that we sort of had planted in us even in high school. But back then and throughout the college, our dating and engagement years, and right up until and including when we got married, we said, you know, our plan, we think we'll have two by birth and we'll adopt two. That was our plan, two and two. And it seemed, you know, doable. It seemed that it would all work out. And so we started on that path. And we did have our first birth child born to us very soon, within, you know, the first year after we were married. And immediately started an application process to adopt. And, in fact, didn't even own a car, so we walked to the local adoption agency with our newborn baby in our arms saying, we want to sign up to adopt. So I often tell people that we should have been laughed out of the room, but we weren't. So we had a social worker who did encourage us and took us under her wing. And after, within the next few years, we did have that little family. We had adopted two, and we had two by birth. And if you do look at our book, you will see on the cover, there is a photograph of that moment in time when we had the two and the adopted two. We had four children as our family. But during that process, and really the reason we often talk about all of this as being a journey, we learned so much. I mean, just the home study itself opened our eyes to so many things that we didn't know about. When we talked about adopting children, we really thought, based on just our life experience at that point, that that would mean children who truly were orphaned, to both parents, you know, no longer living, children who were probably in orphanages, probably in other countries. We didn't know much else. We didn't know about foster care. We didn't know much about abuse and neglect. And so it was very eye-opening, and we learned a lot. During that time, because of what we learned, we decided to become foster parents and really kind of change our trajectory, even of our career goals as well. And one thing led to another, and before you know it, we were especially focused on older children and siblings who had been separated and needed to be have the opportunity to be reunited and be together in the same family again. And you know, and result, our lifetime family is 22 children. Those are the children that comprise our permanent family, and we've had many other children in our life through foster care and kinship care as well.
And the reality is that children the world over, quite frankly, enter into state care. In the U.S., we call it foster care. for much of the same reasons, and it's usually involving abuse and neglect. I mean, there are a few exceptions in international countries where disease plays a role, but abuse and neglect, it tends to be the reasons that children, and both abuse and neglect are traumatic. So it seems to me that one of the realities of adopting older kids who have been abused and neglected is that these kids have experienced trauma. Has that been your personal experience as well as your professional experience?
Absolutely. You know, thankfully, I did major in early childhood development and education even in my college years, and started to learn something about brain development and the impact of different life experiences on that early developing brain. Although back in those years when I was in college, not nearly what is known now was available for the average college student like myself. So the explosion of information about trauma and brain development has been, to some extent, overwhelming, but also exciting, because we really can learn and then apply what we're learning in any, you know, parenting situation or any other work that we do with children. But we absolutely learned from day one that our very first adoption was our son, Jose, from El Salvador. And he was just a little tyke. He was just 2.5 when we adopted him. And yet, clearly, he had experienced so much trauma. Trauma that we weren't even told about. I mean, we didn't know, and not that anyone was really withholding. I think a lot of his background was not known to the people that were working in his life. But, you know, we instantly began to understand that he had fears, he had concerns, he had wounds and scars that we needed to figure out quickly and on the fly, sort of building the plane while you're flying it as a parent, how to best help him both heal and thrive. And so we didn't know really about words like trauma and trauma-informed parenting, and we didn't really know that language then, but that's what we were trying to do and accomplish. And then as we went on with our other adoptions, we did adopt teenagers, and some of our oldest sons and daughters were even over the age of 18 when they joined our family, and we did adopt children with very significant trauma histories in many years. And so thankfully, we've been able to learn as we've gone along about the impact that that has on their lives, and yet the hope that we have, and that we always try to encourage others to have, that there are things you can do that do make a difference when there's been that trauma.
Yeah, well, that's what we'll be talking about some today. It seems to me, what's always been interesting to me is two people, two children or two humans, doesn't matter their age, can experience the same general type of trauma, maybe even the very same trauma. And yet some kids seem able to go on with life without carrying the huge burden of that trauma. But another who experience the same or very similar are going to be permanently damaged and really probably never reach their potential because of the abuse or the trauma. What are some of the factors that you've found that are important in determining how children or how humans respond to trauma?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because really that's one of my passionate topics of late. And really the field of study that's helping us to understand that is what's known as epigenetics. And it's thrilling and fascinating to learn, and it kind of sets aside that whole nature versus nurture question and puts it in a different light of what is the role of nature in nurture, if you will, as they combine to make each of us and each of our children the unique human being that we become. Nature versus nurture is one way that it's been said, or environment and experience as compared to genetics. And it's not the versus concept anymore. We really know that it's the combining of those factors that has been a unique outcome for each individual, even identical twins. So you talked about two children who might go through the same or similar trauma. That's even true when they have the same genetic makeup as well. So if they're two children born to the same two parents and have the same, you know, DNA and same genetic makeup in their system, and go through the same trauma, you're still not going to see an identical response. So it was hard initially for me to kind of get my head around that. And I know from the training that I do that it's really hard for a lot of people, even professionals, because there's this sense, particularly when you see the child who is doing fairly well after significant trauma. We call that resilience generally, but when we see that child who is resilient and is going on with life, as you said, there's a tendency to believe then that the child who isn't doing so well is somehow willfully not doing so well, or is choosing not to do so well, or could do better if only they would be more like their sister or something like that. So this whole concept of how the genetic makeup and the life experience, including the trauma, really work together, it's challenging to get your head around until one day, the thing that helped me the most to understand this, so I'll share it, maybe it'll help some of your listeners, was watching a Navajo rug weaver working on weaving a rug. I was at a particular conference where I was going to be the keynote speaker, but before me they had this special presentation and they had a Navajo woman weaving a rug, and there was a display on the stage of other rugs and blankets that she has also made, and some conversation about the history and the culture that she was demonstrating through this process. Well, all of a sudden it clicked into place, if you think about it this way. If you had a loom and several skeins of yarn, let's just say three for simplicity, red, green, yellow, and you had a weaver like this woman who came into that room and was asked, okay, make me a rug or make me a blanket with this loom and these three skeins of yarn, she could do that. And if you invited that very same person back every single day for an entire year and you didn't change anything, you gave her the same three skeins of yarn to work with every day, she could make a rug or a blanket every day and not any two of them would ever be the same. They would all be different. Even though you had the same material, the hard stuff, the loom and the yarn, and even though you had the same person providing the input into it, the same weaver, you would get a different result every time. Even if she tried to make them identical, they would be coming out different. And as I absorbed that and observed that, I thought, that's what we're talking about here. With each individual unique child, their life, their DNA, if you will, and their genetic makeup is sort of like the hard stuff, the loom, and, you know, the stuff that doesn't change. And then their life experiences, the nurturing that they get, the love that they get or not, and the trauma that they experience or not, all of those things, it's kind of like the inputs coming in, the yarn or the actual weaver. And so it's that combining, that integrating, that interweaving of those experiences and that hardwiring that you have that results in whether how your brain and your psyche, your soul, your spirit, your emotions, as well as your brain and your body, respond to those life circumstances that have come your way. And so if you can have that picture, basically there is life experiences that include trauma do change the brain. They absolutely change the brain. And yet, for some, they change it in ways that they're more easily able to rebound from, and we, like I said, call that resilience. Others, not so much. And there is still somewhat of a mystery on what exactly makes that difference. But the picture of it is that it's that weaving together of those life experiences and the material you bring to the table as an individual, your genetic makeup and so forth, that somehow, when they come together, makes you you and creates the responses that you will have. So I don't know if you find that helpful, but for me it was kind of like a big aha moment that helped me to understand why one child will seem more resilient and another won't. It's not willful. It's not defiant. Not that children can't sometimes be willful or defiant, but the general concept of being resilient or not is not a voluntary thing. It's something that happens during this weaving process that's going on as their life experiences and their brain and their, all their genetic material sort of come together to respond to the situations life puts in their path.
And for others who have an interest in this whole nature versus nurture, it's a topic that I find infinitely fascinating. And as a result, given what I do, if I'm really fascinated in something, if it's relevant to the concept of adoption or infertility, then I get to interview top experts throughout and literally the world. And we have done just that on this topic, including you mentioned the twins. We have two different shows that we've done. I think the title was Nature versus Nurture, and as you point out, that's actually a misnomer. It's because it's not the versus anymore. But the and we had the two leading researchers in the U.S. the heads of the two leading studies, twin studies in the U.S. Talking about what their twins. These are ongoing studies, and that was a fascinating one as well. And I will link to that in the blog tomorrow on that. The other one was one we did just this year, and it was a meta-analysis. The guest was from, I believe, Denmark. Don't worry, her English was perfect. But it was a meta-analysis done on all the twin studies that have been published in the last 50 years. So, in fact, there were, I believe, take all this with a grain of salt, but it's like 1 million twin pairs would have been included in this.
Wow.
And they analyzed the degree that they could determine, based on all these studies, of how much genetics influenced and how much genetics did not influence. So they basically were coming up with a number, and they had thousands of characteristics, temperament, just you name it. They had it was absolutely fascinating, and I'll link to both the both of those in the PS tomorrow or the blog.
Great.
All right. How important is the type of abuse versus neglect or neglect in determining how kids respond? Is there anything that research or experience has shown us that the degree of the abuse, the type of the abuse, be it sexual abuse, be it neglect and versus abuse, be it repeated abuse, be it one-time abuse, that type of thing? Does any of that play a role in how our children might be impacted?
Absolutely, and it's fascinating, actually, because people often associate, when they hear the word trauma, and they consider the possible impacts that might be there for a child, people often associate that with abuse and with the greater severity of the abuse, and particularly sexual abuse. There's an anticipation and an expectation that that would be the worst outcome or the worst scenario for a child, and yet that's not really the case, and that's not what both research and experience have shown us. Interestingly, when we first, in the sort of scientific community, when we first started to learn about trauma, and the first real diagnosis that most people are familiar with about trauma is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, we were really studying, we collectively as a society of the people that were doing the studying, we were really studying adults who experienced trauma by going off to war, really was who we were looking at in those early days. And what we've since come to learn is that the impact of trauma on children, when it initiates, when the traumatic experience initiates early in your childhood, it impacts your brain and it impacts you differently than that same kind of experience happening when you're already an adolescent or adult. And one of the ways in which that's different is part of the definition of childhood trauma is that the child's brain actually believes that when they're going through the traumatic occurrence, that their life is in danger. Their brain, they're not cognitively thinking that, but their brain is absorbing the data sort of coming at them from the circumstance of what's happening and saying, you could die, you could die. And so their brain is saying, this is a life-threatening situation. Now, sometimes it actually is. Certainly some forms of abuse and sexual abuse can be life-threatening. But very often, from a more objective adult perspective, it's not. It's damaging, it's hurtful, it's painful, it's harmful, but it's often not life-threatening. Yet for the child's brain, they're interpreting it as life-threatening nearly each and every time, not only each and every time that they experience abuse of any severity or neglect or sexual abuse of any severity, but the things we call neglect, particularly whether it's absence of nurture, whether it's absence of attachment and absence of adult-child connectedness and interaction, or whether it's absence of physical things you need, like food, or shelter or just supervision so that you don't get hurt, all of those things that we lump under the category of neglect, each time that's happening, the child's brain is saying, my life is in danger. So when you think about it in this perspective, there's typical patterns in families where abuse occurs, whether it's domestic violence, sexual abuse, or other forms of abuse. The pattern is something like this. There will be an abusive episode, a violent episode, hitting, whipping, you know, doing something very horrific or mild, you know, there's a range, of course. But then there will be a calming and cooling down period. And often in between, before the next abusive episode, there's actually sometimes good nurture going on. There's sometimes good parenting going on or a positive relationship development, things happening. That's what happens in domestic violence situations, which is what makes it often so hard for the victim, often the woman, to leave, because there are these good periods in between. And the same is true for children. So in those cases, their little brain is experiencing this sense of being threatened once in a while, but in between, they're getting some good stuff. The child whose background is under all those things we call neglect is experiencing that virtually every day. Every day if they're going without food, or every day if they have a meth-addicted parent who's not attending to their needs and not giving them attachment and nurture, or someone who's just physically not present. Every single day when they're going without those basic human needs, their brain is saying, today could be the day you die. Your life is in danger today, right now. And so they're responding to that trauma daily. So what we've learned from the research and experience is that, in fact, often the things we call neglect can have a more profound or complex traumatic impact on the child even than sometimes abuse can. Clearly, both are bad. We don't want either for a child. But people often think it's the abuse that's the worst thing, and we need to learn that, no, neglect is at least just as bad and often worse in terms of the impact it has on the developing child.
That is fascinating, and I think that we do tend to view, in fact, we hear people in our online support group will say, well, as far as we know, there was no abuse, there was just neglect. But the reality, as you point out, is that neglect is a type of abuse, and we don't often think of it that way. You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about coping with trauma, how to help children cope with trauma. Creating a Family has the largest adoption and infertility communities on the social networks, and we would love to have you join us. We love Facebook around here. There are three ways to connect with us on Facebook. Of course, you can connect with me personally. I'm dawn.davenport1 on Facebook, so please reach out. Creating a Family has two presences as well. There is on Facebook. There is, of course, our Facebook page, which you can find facebook.com/creatingafamily. And we also have our large active support group, and you can find that one. It's a closed group, by the way, so you will have to, others cannot see the post if you're not in the group, and you have to request to join. To find that, it's facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily, all one word. Or the easiest way is to simply type in the words creating a family in the Facebook search box. The page and the group will both pop up. You can like the page and join the group. We'd also love to have you join us on Twitter and Pinterest, and you can find us on both of those at Creating a Family. That's who we go by over there. One of the things that you talked about is that the age and the developmental stage of the child, does it hold true that the younger the child is when they experience the trauma, the greater the risk of long-term impact? Or, as some people think, if the child is not able to remember it, if it happened before their ability to recall, and different people have pinned that age at a different time, but 3 or 4 is the typical age that people think of, that it has less impact because the child basically doesn't remember it. So how does age and or developmental stage of the child when they have experienced abuse or neglect impact how they will be how they will respond or how they will be affected?
The age and the developmental stage of the child is critical and really important to know, or to help guide at least the thinking about what it will take to help the child to heal. And the second sort of scenario that you suggested, that if the child is not old enough to remember or to have cognitively understood what was happening, that they won't be as affected, is a fallacy. It's a common fallacy that not only lay people might have, or you know, potential parents, but even professionals in many fields, including, for example, law enforcement as well as social work and education. So it's not uncommon, for example, when there's a domestic violence call and there was an infant in the household or a young child, for even law enforcement and social work professionals to say, oh, but the baby wasn't even in the room when it happened, didn't see it, was slept through it, so no impact. And what we know from the research is that could not be further from the truth. And again, going back to how we now understand childhood trauma as not being the same as adult trauma, and you'll see that I often do use analogies. I've used a couple already, or pick word pictures, but that's what often helps me understand. And if we, brain scientists talk about the architecture of the brain, so that got me onto this sort of analogy that helps me understand this. If you had two buildings in a community that was struck by an earthquake or a tornado or something, and you hired a consultant to come in after that and look at the damage done to both buildings and give recommendations for how to restore or fix those buildings after the storm, the first thing they would want to look at is the foundation. And then they would determine from that what steps would be needed in order to restore or fix the building. And basically, when we're talking about trauma that happens to older children and then adults, we're basically talking about a building that might have a solid foundation, but then something happens to it. If you think of a building that gets, you know, struck by lightning or shaken during an earthquake or something, but it had a solid, well-built, well-constructed foundation, then if you have to restore it, there's certain things you have to do, certain techniques you would use. But the infant or a very young child who experiences that same kind of traumatic episode going on, they're like the one, the building where the foundation itself might have been built not level, or with cracks in it or something. In other words, the foundation itself of that architecture has issues, challenges, problems, if you will, that need to be addressed in order to do the restoration. So when trauma happens to an infant or a very young child, even whether they can remember it or not, whether they were in the same room when it happened or not, their very foundation of their brain development is being impacted. It does not mean there's no hope. It does not mean it can't be healed, but it does mean the approach you would need to take would be different than if that happened at a later age, because now you're dealing with a foundational issue of your architecture rather than more of a cosmetic issue. So that's why it's important, and the impact on the developing brain of a very young child is very significant and can have healing and can have restoration, but it doesn't just happen automatically. It does take some very sort of concrete and specific intentional strategies.
Well, that leads us actually into a topic I want to talk about, and that is, how is parenting a child who has experienced trauma different than parenting a child that has not? And then the next, after that, after I want you to talk kind of in general, then I want to end up talking about some very specific tips that we can offer to parents who are adopting a child that they either know or have reason to believe has experienced either neglect or trauma. But let's talk just in general how parenting a child who's experienced trauma is different than from parenting a child that has not.
I am going to talk generically and, you know, sort of open that up, and I appreciate you giving me that opportunity. But at the same time, I'm going to use a concrete example to help explain that generic concept. Parenting a child who has experienced trauma is different than parenting a child who's not, because the whole filter that their system has for receiving any kinds of inputs that you try to give as a parent is different. Some people might call that their worldview, the way they absorb or respond to any input, whether it's a hug, whether it's a stern word, whether it's eye contact, whether it's kindness, you know, on all sides of the spectrum, their ability to absorb that and make sense of it and then to respond to it in a way that seems like it makes sense to them is going to be different than a child who has not experienced trauma. So therefore, typical parenting strategies that work well with children who have not experienced trauma just simply don't work as well with children who have experienced trauma. At the same time, those very same non-harmful strategies for parenting might actually become harmful or become re-traumatizing to a child that has experienced trauma. So that's the general, overall, generic answer. And I am going to give one very concrete example that I think helps people understand this better. And that is the concept of using some form of what we typically lump into a category of something called time out as a parenting sort of disciplinary strategy. We might call it time out. It might be time to sit in a, you know, in the old days it was more like stand in the corner. It might be go to your room. It might be sit in the chair. It might just be you can't
play your game
right now.
In our family, we called it the think it. Yeah, we called it the think it over chair.
Right. Okay. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So any of those kind of strategies, certainly they were better than spanking or other kinds of more physically potentially harmful strategies. And, promoted as a great approach to parenting for generations of parents over the last few decades and still in use and often very effective with lots of children. And yet that very strategy can not only not work but actually continue to re-traumatize a child who's experienced trauma, particularly if the trauma was in the area of neglect. But what's happening is, and when we talk about trauma, the brain absorbs new experiences based on the former experience of trauma, and sometimes that involves something we often refer to as trauma triggers. But when you are sending the child away, when you're giving them something that's a timeout, even if they're not out of your presence, but you're kind of metaphorically sending them away by sitting them in a chair or a corner or this or that, that is kind of triggering a trauma response in their brain, that they're being isolated again, that they're being sent away, that they're about to be neglected, that their life might be in danger as their brain had interpreted past trauma. And so not only is it not likely to get the desired parenting result, but it actually can re-traumatize the child. So parents who've used that strategy effectively with other children, birth children, or just, you know, non-traumatized children in their life, try it and find that it doesn't work with this child and can become frustrated and then seeking other kinds of inputs. If someone who's working with the child doesn't understand the trauma history, begins to diagnose, you know, oh, well, it's only because this child has attention deficit or reactive attachment disorder, or somehow starts to put labels on the child, which may or may not be real for that child, but without looking at the underlying trauma, hard to say. So that's one example of how parenting a child needs different knowledge and different strategies when they have a trauma history than what you would need with a child who doesn't have that trauma history. And by the way, if you want an example of, well, then what do you do instead of timeout? I can give you that as well. But I wanted just to paint that picture.
Yeah, paint that picture, and then we're going to come back. Yes, we do try to be pretty practical here. So, yeah, I very much want to come back to that. But let me stop for a moment and to remind people that you are listening to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and infertility, and we're so glad to have you with us. Today we're talking about helping children cope with trauma. We primarily keep in touch with our audience through our weekly e-newsletter. We have two of them, one for adoption and one for infertility. You can sign up for whichever or both. They come out once a week. We keep you up to date with the latest developments in adoption or infertility, as well as tell you about the new resources that we have added to our website that week and the upcoming week's blog topic and show topic. To sign up, you go to our website and on the top right-hand side of every page is a newsletter sign-up. Our guest today is Sue Badeau, and we're talking about trauma and helping children cope. So, yeah, let's talk about some specific things that parents can do. They either they have adopted an older child or even a toddler, any child past infancy, and as you've pointed out, even a child perhaps in infancy can have experienced neglect or abuse. So let's give some practical tips for parents when facing this. What are some things that they can do to help their children?
Great. Well, that's what I really love to talk about, because all of this knowledge doesn't do us any good if it doesn't help us in the day-to-day life with our child. So to first go to my very specific example about don't use timeout, well, then what do we use instead? A really good alternative to timeout is something I call time in, and I'm not the only one that calls it that. But and time in means, yes, you recognize if there's a situation where you would have used timeout, where you would have had to discipline, you don't have to say, well, I'm not going to discipline anymore. You still can. But instead of timeout, time in means you're going to keep that child with you, literally kind of attached at the hip for a certain period of time. With a very young child, it might be 5 to 10 minutes. With an older child, it might be a longer period. The same amount of time that you might use the thinking chair, as you said. And so time in becomes, rather than I'm sending you away, I'm keeping you so close to me. Yeah, it is a consequence. You can't play your game that you wanted to play right now. You can't do whatever you can't continue in whatever you were doing that got you in trouble. You have to kind of stick with me. And if I'm just sitting reading a book, you have to sit next to me. But if I'm doing a chore, you have to come along beside me while I'm doing that chore. Or if I'm, you know, making dinner or I'm sitting at my computer, whatever I'm doing, you have to be right there with me. So it's time in rather than time out. The child doesn't get to do the thing they wanted to do, so it does have a consequence association, and yet it's also showing them that even when they've misbehaved, even when problems have happened, they're not being sent away, they're not being isolated, they're not being re-traumatized or neglected again. And so it begins the healing process in their brain. So that's a very specific example of an alternative to time out. What I'd like to do now is share with you three little easy ways that people can remember the helpful strategies for children that have experienced trauma. I didn't invent these concepts, and I can certainly give you some resources where you can learn more about them, but I have sort of taken these and run with them, and I've worked with the organizations that have created these little ideas and been part of the development of the curricula and training that has come out of that, particularly through the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is a great resource. Anyway, one of the ways to think about this is that it's a three-legged stool, if you will, to think about how do I help children who've experienced trauma. Every moment that child needs to have these three things: safety, connectedness, and the ability to manage their own emotions. Safety has to be both physical and emotional or psychological. They have to feel safe, as well as for you to objectively scour the situation and say as an adult, oh, yes, you're safe here. So we have to think about what will help that child feel safe as well as actually be safe. Connectedness, they have to, again, be with people who are going to make those connections with them. So that's, again, where the time in rather than time out is part of that. And then the other big piece of it, and the one I spend the most time teaching about because it really does help provide the foundation for the other two, is emotional management. So helping children recognize their emotions and express them and recognize your emotions and how to interpret them. Because one of the things we know about children who've experienced trauma is they're overly attuned to negative emotions that adults may portray and have an underdeveloped ability to express their own emotions in healthy ways. So anything from playing charades to puppet play to little storybooks about feelings and emotions and the different facial expressions that go with them, these are important strategies that parents can use to help children, again, at all ages, so you would vary your technique depending on the age of the child, to really learn how to recognize and respond to emotions. And part of that has to do also with the mind-body connection as it relates to emotions. So one thing is to say, oh, and talk about it as a parent. I have goosebumps right now, and that's because I'm excited about our guests that's about to come, or this special TV show that we're going to watch, or this cake we're going to eat for dessert, whatever it might be, but associating, oh, something is happening to my body, and that's telling me about an emotion. Or, oh, my stomach feels kind of upset right now, and I know I'm not sick. I think I might be worried about this big meeting I had at work. Does that ever happen to you when you have a big test happening at school? And so it can be the beginning of a conversation, but the idea of helping the child recognize that sometimes it's their body that's telling them things that are important to help them deal with their emotions. Because what we know is the more they can manage their feelings and their emotions, the better their behavior will become. So that's one way to think about it is safety, connectedness, and emotional management as a three-pronged, three-point triangle or a three-legged stool or whatever you think of. We need all three of those, but the emotional management helps give us the foundation for the other two.
And you said that children who have experienced abuse and neglect are overly sensitive to the negative emotions of the adults in their lives and are also less able to recognize their own emotions. Did I get that right?
Yes, absolutely. And there's a fascinating study where children who've experienced trauma and who have not are shown a variety of facial pictures of faces with all different expressions on them. And the child who has not experienced trauma can understand the differences between things like anger, fear, sadness, disappointment, confusion, frustration. So a lot of those emotions we might lump into something like they're negative, they're less desirable. We don't want to go around during our day being any of those, angry or sad or frustrated or confused. But we know that they're different. And even very young children who have not experienced trauma know that they're different, even if they don't know the words to describe them exactly. They understand that if my parent is angry at me, I might be in trouble. I might even be in danger if I've had that, experience. But if my parent is sad, I'm not in trouble. They're sad. That's different. Or if my parent is confused, I'm not in trouble. That's different. The child who has experienced trauma cannot recognize the difference between those faces. They all signify anger and therefore danger to that child. They cannot say that there's a difference between a sad face and a confused face and an angry face. So that's one example of what I mean here. And so we have to help the facial expressions that they're highly in tune to include fleeting ones. So let's suppose you're a parent who subscribes to the theory of, don't cry over spilled milk. Literally, assuming your child spills milk at the dinner table, and you know that you are not going to let that bother you, you're not going to get upset, you're not going to yell, you're not going to give a consequence, you're just going to matter-of-factly clean it up, that's all good. But you might have had one split tenth of a second where your face kind of had a moment of frustration. Oh, spilt milk again. And you got it under control before you even really knew about it being there, but the child picks up that flash that no one else has even noticed, and then responds accordingly. Or in your voice tone, you may not be yelling, but your child may interpret it as yelling if they're looking at your face and feeling that you're angry. In fact, the child may say, "You're always yelling at me." It's not hyperbole. They may be actually hearing your voice as yelling if they're seeing what they consider anger on your face. So helping the child recognize those different emotions, both in others and in themselves, not only helps them to get along better with other people, it dramatically helps their behavior.
So how do we help our children recognize the distinctions between all of those potentially negative, but they don't all mean the same thing? So how do we help our kids distinguish between anger, sadness, fear, disappointment,
The best way that I've found to do it, well, I should say a couple of best ways. One is certainly modeling, and maybe modeling in an exaggerated way a little bit, and talking it through as you're modeling it. I'm sad right now. This is how my face looks when I'm sad. Does it look angry to you? No, I'm not angry, but I'm really sad. So talking about it, modeling it, raising the underlying issues, and doing that through play whenever possible, again, with puppets. I do a game that I teach children and families called Feeling Charade, where you get a name of a feeling written on a paper, and you have to act out that feeling. And then after you've, you know, it's been guessed correctly or not, you talk about, well, how is that different than this? How is fear different than anger? Those kinds of things. So doing it lightheartedly, doing it not in the heat of the crisis moment, but when you can be calm and you can make a game out of it and you can talk about it. Another way to do it, particularly for older kids, is using things like music and television programs. I love an activity with older kids of watching a television program with the sound off and talking about what do you think they're feeling based on their body language and their facial expression. What emotions are they having? How can you tell? And again, kind of making a game out of it and trying to help them learn and experience those different things. So those are two examples, the charades and the TV show watching. Listening to music, what feeling does this music bring out in you? How does it feel for you? How might it feel for someone else? How would your face look when you have that feeling? How would someone else's face might look when they have that feeling? So just being really intentional and open and articulate, you know, actually articulating these different feelings, using those little charts with little kids with the facial expressions on them. So there's lots of ways you can do it, but the most important thing is to be aware that it needs to be done and then finding creative and fun ways to just incorporate it into the everyday family life.
And I'm so appreciative. I'm thinking so much about the fleeting emotion, because I think of myself as being perhaps guilty of that, whereas I don't want to sweat the small stuff in life. And I make a conscious effort as a parent and as a person to not sweat the small stuff. However, I have no doubt that there is a fleeting moment, because in my mind, oftentimes I'll go, oh, crap, you know, I got to deal with this now. You
yeah.
know?
So,
and,
right.
and so I'm thinking that. And then the cognitive part of my brain kicks in and said, Dawn, this is small stuff, and I get it under control. And all of this may have only happened in a very short period of time. And in my mind, I've handled it beautifully. And yet I totally can see that I was transparent in that maybe it lasted for 5 seconds, but that initial reaction, which is, oh, crap, now I got to deal with this. So what are some tips? Because I don't know that it's possible for me to take away that 5 seconds, or maybe it is. Maybe that's what I need to be focusing on. How do we allow those 5 seconds to show?
It's almost not possible, so not to beat ourselves up, it's human, you know, and so there is going to be that. So, but we can practice as adults mindfulness types of activities, and there is some good research that shows that these things do help both with trauma-informed care and with parenting in general, things like yoga or meditative practices or, you know, your spiritual practices, prayer, other things like that, but also just a mindfulness activity like eating one Hershey Kiss and focusing on nothing but that for 2 minutes. You know, that's an easy one and one that people usually like because it's chocolate. But
yeah. Sounds finding, pretty good to me.
Finding ways to do, yeah, exactly. I tend to give out chocolates when I teach a class on this and teach that particular strategy. But so anything we can do to increase our own mindfulness as parents does help reduce those five-second episodes. But it's almost impossible to eliminate. So the other thing, and I'm glad you asked the question because it really leads us into the next part of what I wanted to say was that we're not always going to be able to prevent. So everything I've been saying before is kind of how do we help the child learn things that will help them prevent being triggered by their trauma and prevent their meltdowns and so on. Well, we can't always prevent everything in life. So the other thing we need to do is have healthy ways to respond. And the most important first step in that is to be able to do self-soothing or self-calming. Because when your brain really does go into that trauma-triggered state, you're basically in fight or flight mode. Your brain has kind of turned off the thinking part. The child's brain clicks like a light switch off from thinking into fight or flight. And it's so quick when there's a triggering thing, even that little 5 seconds that you just described, that nothing we do that appeals to the cognitive part of their brain is going to work in that moment. We can't say you'll get a consequence. We can't say you'll have early bed. We can't say you get dessert if you bring it together. We can't use any either positive reward or negative consequence type of cognitive appeal in that moment and expect it to work, because that part of their brain literally in that moment is shut off. So what we have to do is help their brain to turn it back on. And that involves self-soothing and calming, and it particularly involves breathing, deep, slow breathing, as opposed to the quick, shallow breathing that happens when you are in fight or flight. So we want to do things like help our children learn little breathing strategies they can use when you have that five-second moment, or when there's something bigger than the five-second moment that triggers a trauma response in them. We want to help them. That's why the mind-body connection work that I was talking about is important. When you start to see a sign that you think you're going to be upset, you know, that you recognize that you're getting upset, how can you do this breathing technique that's going to help your brain stay in more control? So it can be, you know, deep belly breathing. It can be count to 10 breathing. There's a lot of strategies we can use. Pretend you're blowing out the candles on a birthday cake. Pretend you're blowing up a balloon, actually blowing out candles, actually blowing up a balloon. But my favorite one, frankly, is to use bubbles, little bottles of bubbles. I tell parents who are parenting children who've experienced trauma to just keep dozens of those bottles of bubbles everywhere, in your house, your purse, your child's room, your kitchen drawers, everywhere, and pull them out at a moment's notice when they're needed. It requires you to do some focused breathing, and it helps turn that thinking part of the brain back on, and it's a self-soothing or calming technique that a child can learn to do on their own even at a very young age. But even if they're not yet doing it on their own, if you do it with them or even kind of for them, you just start doing some rhythmic breathing, you start doing some controlled breathing, pretty soon it becomes contagious and they catch on and they start doing it. So helping children learn how to do calming things like that, and like I said, one of my favorite tools is bubbles, is very important. But then, and I know we're getting short on time, but I just want to mention one other thing that besides using bubbles and calming techniques that you might be familiar with, another way to think of how do I help my child become calm and then stay calm even in the face of trauma triggers or other circumstances, difficult, stressful, anxiety-provoking circumstances, is use your five senses and your child's five senses. Think about, for each sense, is there something using this sense, so let's talk sight for a moment, is there something using my eyes, what can I look at that helps me feel calm? So for one person, it might be if I look at some picture with blues and greens and lavenders in it, because that's calming. But for someone else, I might want to look at a picture of my favorite or a person from my past that was important to me, or waterfall, or, you know, find something that you can look at when you need to restore calm in yourself or your child. And this is the same thing for sound, something you can touch. I don't use taste quite so often, but taste. But then the most important one, smell, because our sense of smell is very primitive in our brain, and it is the sense that often triggers the trauma response, but it's also the sense that can give us the relief. So that's why aromatherapy and things like that are so popular in certain circles that work with people who have stress in their life and trauma. But what we have to understand about children is we have to help them find their own soothing scent. And so we can start with the ones that are often kind of sold, you know, oh, lavender helps people feel calm. Start with that, see if it works. But you know what? It might be the scent of a particular laundry detergent. It might be the scent of a particular food. It might be the scent of a dog that's come in after the rain. I mean, they might not be things we normally would think of as soothing, but help your child find something that they can look at and smell and listen to, those three in particular, senses, when they're getting agitated or upset, that will help them calm. And then try to find small pocket-sized pieces of that thing that they can keep with them at all times. So a little picture they can carry with them, a little, you know, Ziploc bag with something in it that they can smell. I mean, if it is lavender, for example, you can get lavender dryer sheets and cut them up in little squares and put them in Ziploc bags, and you can have a smell of lavender whenever you want. But you can do that with other things as well, cinnamon, vanilla, anything like that. And a sound, is there a way you can help them have a chance to listen to either a certain piece of music, or one person I know, it was the sound of their washing machine that brought them back to calm, or, you know, what can we do and how can we help using the senses to help bring, restore calm when that anxiety begins to develop, and doing it as soon as possible before the anxiety gets out of control really helps the child, A, feel more in control, and then secondly, be able to actually exercise more control in their life and in their behavior.
For the sound, specifically, other than having it, you know, on your phone or whatever, having the child record the sound of, like, for me, a washing machine would not work, but there are certainly
right?
sounds that would. The sound of the washing machine would take me in a different direction, I'm sure, increase my stress. But the just having the child record it on their phone, and is that specifically what you're saying? Record the sound of the music,
yeah,
or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay. And then
record
as a parent,
it on a phone or a tape recorder, or, you know, anything that the child can have access to. Exactly.
Then as a parent, are we reminding our children during this that go to your three, your sound, smell, and let's see, sight? Do we remind them to when we notice that they are beginning to spin out of control, or
yeah,
do we physically bring them out to try to bring them back into control?
Both. I mean, and again, partly depends on the age, but we can bring them out, we can do them parallel, we can just do it with, you know, in front of the child so that hopefully it becomes contagious, or we can remind them, or we can do both. We get to know our individual child, what works for them. We can call it your brain toolkit, you know, the things that help your brain, your safety toolkit. There's different ways it's been responded, it's been called, but whatever works with your child, oh, now's the time for that, you know, let's use that. And we can either use it together, or we can give them a little time and space to use it on their own.
Yeah, and of course, I would assume that this takes a fair amount of awareness on the parent's part, because the ideal is to take it before, to do this before the child is in complete meltdown mode. Because the further out the child has spun out of control, the harder it is to bring them back into control. I'm assuming that would be the correct thing, right?
That's absolutely right. And it does take a lot of observation and really getting to know what will work with your child and trying things out. But then it becomes easier over time once you've done that harder work of that observation and getting in sync and in tune with your child around those issues. But then it's very empowering for the child, too, because now they have a little more. No child likes to feel out of control. They don't. The temper tantruming two-year-old or the drug-using teenager or anyone in between, they know they're out of control and they don't like how it feels. But that's all they know to do in that moment. So the more we give them tools where they can control themselves, they feel empowered. So kids like these tools. They like to have it within their own control that they can manage those very troubling or challenging emotions that come up.
Yes, and I agree with you. And the other thing is, and from what you're saying, and it's the harder part, is that because often we as parents bring our own issues to the table, and we are also beginning to get panicky because we see our child getting intense, or whatever the signs our child are giving us that this may become a big meltdown, and we start getting anxious as well because we think, oh, I know where this is going.
That's right.
So, which is particularly hard. Yeah, such good advice and such good resources. I'd like to take a moment to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and to remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show as well as all the resources at Creating a Family. We have Nightlight Christian Adoptions. They have offices in California, Colorado, and South Carolina, and adoption programs throughout the world, including a domestic infant program and their Snowflakes Embryo Adoption Program. We have Spence Chapin. They are a full-service adoption agency bringing over 100 years of experience in a new direction, creating permanent, loving families for children most in need, older kids, siblings, and kids with special needs. And last but not least, Independent Adoption Centers, whose mission is to provide open adoption placement and counseling to birth and adoptive families that they work with throughout all 50 states. Well, Sue, we have come to the end of our time together, and I'm sorry, because we could keep going. I've barely touched all my list of questions. If for those of us who are listening, please take a moment if you'd like to help us out, and we would really appreciate it if you would. Could you give us a rating on iTunes? iTunes uses the ratings in order to rate the shows and how they recommend shows to people. We are by far the top-rated show on iTunes in these topic areas, and we would like to stay there, and it would help us if you would just take a moment and pop over to iTunes and give us a rating. It's going to be either a star rating, or if you particularly want to, we'd love if you just leave a comment. But we'll settle for a star rating, so just give us, that's a 1 to 5, and so please pop over there and do that. Thank you so much, Sue Badeau, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. I am going to blog on the topics of this show tomorrow, and I might even blog at another time. We will link to the show then as well. I know that everyone now is going to want more information about Sue, when she is going to be speaking, and also resources she has. She has a wonderful website. It is chock full of information and resources. And you can also check out her speaking calendar there. That website is suebadeau.com, S-U-E-B-A-D-E-A-U, suebadeau.com. You can pop over there and get that information. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, wah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.